talking with Adolf Hoffner, and you know, you just mentioned that you do speak Czech, but where were you born at?
I was born in Shiner, Moulton, Texas. Yeah.
What's your birthday?
Oh, well, I was born in the fine year. No, 39 is how old I am. But I,
lie.
But I was born in 1916, about June the 8th. I'm going to have another 39 coming up now. Hey, it's going to be backwards. Yeah.
Did your folks speak
Oh, yeah. That's Czech? The first language I learned how to speak was Czech. Mm-hmm. And naturally, my mother was a Kubina. That was about Czech as you can get. My daddy was a, well, he was about half squarehead, you know, Hoffner. That's definitely a good squarehead name. So the first tongue I learned to speak was Czech till my first day in school. Naturally, German, being around it, I can savvy some of the words too, you know.
Did your father speak German?
Oh, yes. He could read it, write it, Czech, Bohemian, and German, both. Now, I think his language at home, when he was at home, was German again, you see. Uh-huh. However, there's a bunch of Czechs too. I think his mother was Czech. I don't know. I was getting delving back into history, you know.
What was the first kind of music that you heard when you...
Well, it was naturally the old polka bands, you know, Bohemian music. Uh-huh. And when they had a dance, well, maybe they had it once a month, maybe. Or maybe one community had it one... 4 weeks, and then next 4 weeks somebody else had it, or vice versa, you know. Mm-hmm. But that was my first recollection of bands, was definitely the old Tommy polka bands.
Was the Patek Orchestra already going at that time?
I don't think so. I think that Joe might have been playing with some of them, but then again, it seems to me, well, the biggest names in bands that I recollect that were polka bands that were well known was the Baches, the Bache band. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Oh yeah, they also recorded. I think they were the first to record.
That's right. We had some of their records naturally, but they were hard to get. And then you know what I mean. Very popular. And there was a bunch of bands around there. I can recollect some of them. Well, naturally, later on, Fred and Steve Gardner, you know. You've heard of them, haven't you? Oh, they were terrific back in that day. However, they didn't play so much the polka music as they did the big name sounds, you know.
Those are the swing bands?
They were what you call, some of the old, dating way back, they got Lombardos and stuff. They played popular music, you see. Mm-hmm. And they'd have them just for some big celebrations. However, let's see, Fred and Steve Gardner, that's who they were. And then there was the, there was another bunch of boys over there. Maybe I'll get to it without wasting a lot of time on tape. Oh my goodness, they were very popular back there in my days when I was a kid. Uh-huh. Fred Gardner, Gardner? Steve Gardner, have you heard of them?
No.
Steve Gardner was going.
What other kind of music did you hear when you were growing up? Because they didn't really have any Western swing yet at that time.
They didn't. My first recollection of music actually was what really got me interested in strings. Actually, the first songs I've heard was on these graphophone or phonograph, you know what they call them, that graphophone, you know. And or gramophone, several names, but there was songs like Sonny Boy, you know, Al Jolson, and then about the first song I remember was It All Depends on You. I forgot who put that out, and then there was the Hawaiian songs, you see, and that's what got me and my brother started in strings. I thought they were so pretty, the Hawaiian guitars, you see. And actually, Western music, that was unheard of. They had it going, I'm sure they did, but not in my community, you see. Uh-huh. They probably had it over here up in the hill country and stuff like that. They had hoedowns, and I'm sure they did, as a matter of fact. I know they did. But there wasn't very many such things as guitars, you know. Back in community I lived with, it's all brass and drums and tubas and vice versa. Uh-huh. But what got me interested in that was steel guitars. I like the way they whine, you know.
Yeah.
And also see them in these Sears Roebuck catalogs, you know. And I figured it was easy, could be easy to play, you know. Mm. And so, anyhow, me and my brother finally ordered one, like the broke it before we got to the house. It was a ukulele. Mm. Me and my brother Bash, we've been in this business, him and I, neck to neck. Forever.
Is he a little older? Or?
He's a little younger, 2 years younger. Mm-hmm. But we was in it neck and neck. From the time I started, he started, we both seemed to enjoy the same thing of playing, you see. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, when we took lessons on guitar later on in about the fine year of 30, 31, mm-hmm. why, we both took guitar. But then it didn't make sense to us that really us both strumming away on a guitar. Mm-hmm. So he got interested in the steel guitar, you see. And that's where we branched off. The first deal we started was a trio. We had a trio, two pieces, naturally played around the house mm-hmm. with steel guitar and standard, you know. And as a matter of fact, our first nightclubs that we played, or clubs that we played, or beer joints, or whatever, why, we played just him and I, you know. And we set, he played steel and I played standard, and we set our little kitty out there and see what the heck we could collect. We didn't know over 10, 15, 20 songs. We played them over and over, you know. But we made 40, 50 cents a night back then. In them days, that was quite a bit of money. That was back in the...
Started the
30, early 30, maybe 29. And then we got a little trio started called the, we'll call ourselves the Hawaiian Serenaders. It was Simon Garcia, he played ukulele. And Bash played steel and I played standard. However, we, you know, build up our knowledge of songs and things, you know, we got to learn more songs. But we more or less stayed with the Hawaiian and the popular, you uh-huh. see. And then we had a bass man that we worked with. It was our first pretty good job we got. We was making a dollar a night right here at the Big Orange on Broadway and Alamo. You know where it's at?
No, but when did your family move to San Antonio?
Oh, back in about 1926.
Oh, 1926.
26, yeah. We moved to San Antonio. Uh-huh. But that's why I say we was interested. Bash and I were from the time we were toddlers. I mean, we was about 8, 9 years old, you see. And we first ukulele we ordered from Sears. Before we got it home from the mailbox, real mailbox, we liked to tore it up. Mm-hmm. He wanted to play it first night, you know, how kids are. But anyhow, we managed to not break it. So, but anyhow, both of us played, you know, and, one of these home study courses. it was fun. It was, between him and I, it was a little competition, you know. But my main object was to sing, you see, and that's the reason why I had no desire to pick up a lead instrument. And to this day, I don't play one, but my brother does. Mm-hmm. He went ahead and, like I say, we finally compromised and said that he might as well learn how to play something with a lead. So mm-hmm. he could play the lead and I'd strum along with him, you see, and that's what we done. Well, that went along, like I say, we played these nightclubs and mm-hmm. little joints sometimes. They'd set us up on tables, you know, mm-hmm. just to attract attention and mm-hmm. cars and stuff listened to us play and then they'd buy something. That was the old gimmick mm-hmm. then, you see. That was the deal at the Big Orange. We worked there from 8 or 9, I guess, 9 till 11. Must have been 8 to 11. We worked 3 hours. Got a dollar, boy, that was big money. So that was the gimmick. We was on a stand, cars are just lying up, man. And it was awful just to hear us three guys play. All right, so that went on, actually. But at that time, Bing Crosby was very popular on the airwaves. Kate Smith, she was on the airwaves, that's all you hear. And maybe you heard some old Lonesome Cowboy from down Eagle Pass, Piedras Negras, you know. It didn't send me, you see, because everything was centered more or less on popular music, you see. Russ Colombo and Bing Crosby. And the bands, you know, that you heard on records, I'm sure they had some Western recordings, but more or less I prefer the dance type. You see the songs with the beat and the, with a band behind them, not just that strumming over there. And even Jimmy Rogers, as much as I kind of liked him, and I was just about the stage where my voice was breaking, you see, and I've done a pretty good job of yodeling. Yeah. So that must have been in, what, 26, 27, about 27, when Jimmy Rogers was so popular, I think. Brakeman's Blues and all that. Naturally, I learned them. I liked, because then later on he came out with a steel guitar behind him and stuff like that. Well, I began to dig that because it had a beat to it, you see, not just sitting over there and lonesome cowboy, so damn lonesome, nobody wanted to hear him, you know. So then came along and Milton Brown and his Brownies. Now that's what sold me on Western music, because they had a band.
Did you see him play?
I saw him. I never did get to see Milton. I missed that, but I saw the Brownies play. Naturally, they never played. Maybe they were 200 miles away. Well, nowadays, my gosh, 200 miles. You took two days to make arrangements for the trip, you know. But I managed to hear him playing Brownwood. One time, but that was after Milton got killed. Yeah, but and Durwood Brown. Durwood was leading the band then, and Cecil Breyer. He was playing fiddle, I'm sure, because they had two fiddle players. But what impressed me was old Durwood just sitting there and beating the heck out of that guitar, and then he had a boy standing right next to him, and he'd break strings. When he'd break strings, he'd have this other boy put one on and tune it for him. Then he'd lay the other one. That was his gimmick. I didn't know it then. See. But that was his gimmick, and he knew how to break them strings, believe me. He'd break one about 10, 15 minutes. And the people that watch him, you know, because he'd beat on that thing so hard, on a string, you know, and then he'd hand it over to the guy, pick up another one, see. You know, everybody has a gimmick. At that time, I thought he was really beating himself to death, but actually he wasn't. However, he was playing that thing. Don't think he wasn't, because it was an amplifier. The only instrument they had that was amplified was a steel guitar, Bob Dunn on steel guitar, and boy, that boy played it. But getting back to the story and the PA set, they had the PA set, banjo, rest of it. That's the reason they used to have banjo, you see. They didn't use drums, so they used banjo to give it the rhythm. But anyhow, that's what I like. Now, when he came out, when Milton Brown came out, I thought he was wonderful. Because that's what I like. You see, it had the steel there, it had the rhythm there, the drive, and it had the instrumentation, you see. And that was, must have been back in about 34, I'm getting that backwards, 34, 35, somewhere along in there. They first come out with Fan It. Incidentally, I think you've got it on one of your albums, haven't you? Fan It.
I forgot if it's by him or by somebody.
Or Bill Boyd. It might be by Bill Boyd. I think Bill Boyd came out with that too. But
It's hard
and
for me
four
to
or five
tell.
Times, you remember four or five times you've got that, and then a brownie from one of you. Well, anyhow, I thought that was the finest. And the way he played that steel guitar, it sounded like a horn, which I like horns because it's the first thing I've heard was horns, you see. And it all added up to it, and that's when I began to get interested in string music, you see, along with the popular. And then Nobody's Darling But Mine came out, Jimmy Davis, and it sounded good, smooth, plenty of rhythm, nice danceable tempos, you see. It was exactly what I admired in music, you see.
You didn't hear the Bob Wills stuff, because they
I'm getting to that now. Bob Wills came out. Brown was out. Now, if he did, I haven't heard of it. The first thing I've heard of Bob Wills was Trouble in Mind. Now, Trouble in Mind. And I liked Bob's band, all right. But to me, it was musically, it sounded flat. Now, you will agree with me that for some of them first recordings was sour. I can't help it what they say. They were sour. Evan Brown's wasn't. It was smooth. It was clicking. Their rhythm was clean, you see. You don't believe it, you compare the two. Even though those horns, I like the horns, the type of horns, but they weren't in pitch, you see. They just weren't together. It sounded like it was all jumbled up. Raggedy. You said it. And therefore, it never did click until this trouble in mind came out. And Bob might have made a jillion of them before that, but that's what brought Bob to me. It was trouble in mind, and then let's see, what was the... there were some others he had. He had quite a few after he started coming out. Well, after that one hit, financially, he had quite a few. I can't remember that, but trouble in mind I do, because I had to learn it. That's all they wanted to hear was trouble in mind, trouble in mind. And incidentally, I didn't care much for Tommy Duncan singing, even though everybody thought he was king. I didn't. I thought Milton Brown, nothing to compare to Milton. As a matter of fact, I even changed my style of singing to try to sound like Milton, because I mean to tell you, I thought that man was it. Well, so much for that. So, and that's the Bill Boyd and his Skyboy Rambers. They came along, and I began to get into the type of stuff, because that's what the people wanted. Maybe I didn't especially care for some of them. I still like Lost in a Fog, and remember some of them old numbers?
Yeah,
you probably have them. And Treasure Island by Crosby. That was my love, boy. But that wouldn't make my living, you see. So I began to go the other way, and as I went the other way, I began to like it, you see, because I found out some of it had a lot of soul to it besides just whining away, you see. Mm-hmm. So I got into this Western, naturally, because that's what was paying off. Mm-hmm. And so I got into it, and but I kept my popular right along with it, because I still love that. So I began to branch off into both. And then as I went along and started playing the territory, all this music that my mama used to sing, you see, it all came back to me. So when I'd hit the Czech territory, I'd play some of those. Even my guys played with me. They had never heard of it, see, and much less in Bohemian. You know. But as we played it, I noticed that people liked it. And that's when I began to make records, and they bought it, you see. Mm-hmm. And I found out that that's what they liked, so I liked it too, you see.
How did it come about when you made your first record? How did they meet
the
up
first
with
record,
your...
The first record I made...
Is it for the Bluebird?
It was Bluebird, yeah. And I made that with Jimmy Rivard and the Oklahoma Playboys. And that was made, must have been in 34 or 35, real early there. It might have been early part of 36, but it had to be between the last part of 35 and 36, because that's when Jimmy, I was playing this little beer joint right here in Monte Carlo Inn on Nogalitas. Mm-hmm. We was working there 6-7 nights a week, and Jimmy wanted to organize an event and go on the road. We tried it before this, with this Jimmy Rivard deal. We tried it under the name of Texas Wranglers, but we found that the bookings were very hard. Nobody knew us, no good. In other words, there was too many radio bands, you see, and we weren't a radio band, so didn't have it. So all right, as far as they were concerned. So then Jimmy Rivard started his band. He said he's going to get a radio program, which he did.
Was he from here too?
He was from here, but he ran into us at the Monte Carlo Inn. He'd come out there and he liked my singing, you know, he liked us playing, so he said, I'd like you guys going to work, I'm going to organize a band. He was going to play bass, but then he hired a bassman so you wouldn't have to fool around. He had a lot of money. He had some of that Osage money, you know. He was from Oklahoma, I think.
Uh-huh.
And his wife was getting a royalty check, which,
oil,
I don't know, yeah, oil royalty. See, I imagine it was about $800 or $900 a month. Well, you know what that was then. He drove them cords and big cars and motorcycles. Bless his heart, but he was a wonderful fellow. And anyhow, so we did. We went along with him. And so we got a radio show here. It was KTSA. Always out delved around KTSA. And we was on that show for a while, and then he decided he'd go down the valley because it was fresh territory, you see. And so we went down there, and we left our radio program here then. We went down to the valley, built ourselves Jimmy Rivard, the Oklahoma Playboys, you see. And we was on that KRGV radio station. Ain't that the one? Yeah, Rio Grande Valley, yeah, KRGV in Weslaco, 50,000 watts. We was on there every day at noon. And the valley wasn't ready for Western music, man. Not at all, man. It was all Guy Lombardi, you know, it was a lot of northern folks over there. See, it was all Guy Lombardo and Mexican music. That's all it was. As far as strings, that was something that you tossed string bands, you know. Like you didn't, well, we like to starve to death. We was out there 3 months, and it would have been for bologna and some credit from a Coles grocery store we'd been taught. But we had bologna for breakfast, dinner, and supper. So finally we left there, and we come back, and we started playing around here, you know, got a radio program, KTSA, and we done fairly well, you know. But then he got a sudden notion that he was as big as Bob Wills. See, he called himself the Oklahoma Playboy. See, Bob Wills had the Texas Playboy. And he was after Bob Wills, you see. So he said, I'm going to Oklahoma. He said, you boys come along. He said, I'll give you all a guarantee, you see. I forgot what, it's $15, $16 a week, you know. So we went up there, and he didn't do any good at all, man. I played in big ballrooms then. Band competition to Bob Wills, my gosh. Who ever heard of Jimmy Rebod and the Oklahoma Playboys? And Bob Wills plastered all over that state of Oklahoma.
Tulsa,
everywhere, all Kansas, Tulsa. And like I say, Oklahoma, Kansas, Arkansas, all Texas, all around there, see. With recordings of a year or two of fine record sellers. It's kind of comical, you know. But anyhow, so I checked out of there, and it just wasn't any good. Like, the froze to death, too. It was in Kansas, so I left them. My brother stayed on. But I came back, and I was going to quit the music business.
Did you record with the band?
I did. That's what I was going to. Uh-huh. All right, now here's what happened. See, I recorded with Jimmy Rebar and the Oklahoma Playboys for Overstein.
For Bluegrass.
Bless his heart. He was a wonderful gentleman. He was right there. If you didn't understand, you thought he's going to tear your head off every moment. But he was a heck of a nice guy. He knew what he wanted, even if he had to make the men mad to get it, you see. Get all teed up, and then they'd give him a good record, you see. All right. So Obie, he liked me. And then he went through, he passed through here, recording, and Jimmy Rebard was in Oklahoma, you see.
Do you remember some of the titles that you did with that band? Or?
Of my band?
No, when you were with the Rebard.
Jimmy Rebard, the first recording I ever made was Dirty Dog. Dirty Dog Blues. I don't know whether you've got it on that or not.
I'm not sure, but that was just the session that you were on.
That was the session I was on. I recorded with him. And
you were on guitar? And
I was on guitar.
What did Jimmy Rebard play at that time?
A bass on that. And he played a little bit of clarinet, too. He played bass and clarinet, a little bit of guitar.
Who else was in his band? You remember that?
At the band at the time, yes. I can tell you exactly. Curly Williams. Or did Curly Williams come in later? We made two sessions. The first session was myself, my brother Badge, Jimmy Rebard, Ben McKay on fiddle, and what was this fella's name on piano? He was from, I don't know whether it's Eddie Whitley. It might have been Eddie. It was either Eddie Whitley or a fella from up north. I can't think of his name. Oh my goodness. I used Eddie Whitley on that first session on piano. Well, naturally, we didn't use no drums. And Cotton Cooper played banjo. Then he hired Q.D. Stevens to play bass, see, so he'd have all the, he could get off the bandstand, walk around, and, you know.
Meet all the folks.
Yeah, there you go, yeah. All right, so I think that was the first original band. And then on the second session, Curly Williams, it was Curly Williams.
What did he play, Steve?
He played bass.
What did it be?
Yeah, he played bass, and I was on standard, Bash on steel, Jimmy Rebard, you know, it's more or less same goes. Curly played bass, see, and I was a good guitar player. He was a good guitar player, too, but naturally I done had the job of playing guitar, so he had to play that dang doghouse, which he didn't like. Poor old Curly, he's still around. Let's see, who played banjo then? I believe it was one of the Ruff twins. Yeah, I believe it's one of the Ruff twins playing banjo then. Or was it Cotton Cooper? Still Cotton Cooper. It might have been. Chet Carnes. It was Chet Carnes, that's who it was on banjo. On that second section.
Uh-huh. Do you remember any of the titles you did?
Oh my gosh. I know you've got one there by Curly. I know you've got one there by Curly. Gosh almighty, if I could just, let's see. Hold in the Sack was one. Jim Rebard, Hold in the Sack. I think you've got
think
that
I
on.
I remember that.
Yeah, Hold in the Sack and let's see, Deep. No, I said Dirty Dog Blues. Says Deep Ellum Blues, the first recording
the first
I ever made in my life.
Deep Ellum Blues.
Deep Ellum Blues.
By the Jimmy Rivard Band.
By Jimmy Rivard and the Oklahoma Playbook. Deep Ellum Blues.
That should become a popular song.
Yeah. It? Well, you see, it was popular before we recorded it, see, but then we more or less kind of, I think the Delmore brothers put that out first, and they were one of the, some kind
it
of
was
brothers.
One of those brothers.
Yeah, there was so many of them going on that about that time.
Shelton Brothers.
Shelton Brothers, you're right. Mm-hmm.
And,
And there's a fella by the name of George Timberlake on piano in that second session. And let me see, we still didn't have drums then. They just weren't using drums. They used banjo for rhythm instruments, see, to break, cut through. And let's see, who else? That's all. He had about six pieces, working pieces, that is. It was seven with him, but six working. All right, that was second session. Well, in the second session, then is where I met Mr. Oberstein, and I don't know, I must have sang some song on there that impressed him, you see, because he thought I sounded like Bing Crosby. He was going to try to make another Bing Crosby out of me. So when he come through here, I, like I say, I left him and went, came back to San Antonio. Why, then he called me up for a recording session, see, just under my own name, which I did. It was Adolph Hoffner and the Texans.
Was that the time when you did Brown Eyed Sweet? Or,
I think so. I think so. Yeah, that was the first time. Yeah, first. And let's see, what else did I record on that? Good heavens, I had a bunch of them, man.
Who were the guys that you had with you there?
Well, with me was Smiley Whitley. And
what did he play?
He played steel. Uh-huh. See, my brother was in Oklahoma with Jimmy.
Oh, he stayed up there.
Stayed up there. That's the only one. Let's see, who else was on? Smiley Whitley, myself, and George Pendleton was on piano on that record. And Someone Thinks of Someone was a beautiful rendition. Someone Thinks of Someone. Hmm. Someone Thinks of You. That was one of the songs I remember was on there. That one was the one that got the biggest play. Uh-huh. Well, Someone Thinks of Someone.
It had kind of a sweet sound.
Sweet sound to it, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And was J.R. Chadwell on fiddle on that?
No. J.R. didn't start. I'm coming to J.R. Uh-huh. That's a long story, man. All right. Well, and the fiddle player was Johnny.
Was Johnny Williams?
Was Johnny Williams. Yeah, finally got the name. I couldn't think of it.
Session.
Yeah, and incidentally, Johnny hired me to play a house dance with him. That was before I knew anything about hoedowns, you see, or a shoddy or anything like that. And so there we were, and I was playing these fine chords, you know, like I call them
like
in them days.
Pop music.
Yeah, pop music, yeah. And he was strictly, he didn't knew nothing but hoedown, shoddy, just put your little foot, see. That's the first time I played. He hired me playing house band, just him and
that
I.
That was here in San Antonio.
Here in San Antonio. So, it was funny, man. He didn't know what I knew, and I didn't know what he knew, you see. So there we were, man. The only thing we really got together with was Ragtime Annie and that shoddy. You finally figured it out how it went. It sounded all beat to me, the way it played it, you know, but it's right in beat. And Put Your Little Foot, that was easy for me. It came easy. But so much for that. It was a lot of fun. We worked it, I guess, 3 hours. I don't know what we made, $5 a piece, I think. But it was funny. I guess he felt funny. I sure felt funny trying to follow him. So, but anyhow, so I used him on this first session I made. Johnny Williams and George Pennington, he played piano. And Smiley Whitley Steele and Buck Wheeler played bass. And there's five of us made that session. And Someone Thinks of Someone, that's the one I was telling you about. and Someone Is Alone, and Home Sweet Home. Now, a bunch of my songs, they were on there. Someone Is Alone was another one, but more or less it came out on a sweet a deal, you see. And let's see, Oh How I Miss You Tonight was another one I made on there. And I tried to talk it off like Milton Brown. You know, he had a lot of this talking stuff, see. And I said, well, I'm going to try to do it like I think that he would have done it. See? So I sang it and talked one verse off, see, on it. And I don't know, I guess it old pretty good. Just laying around a few jukeboxes, words, you know. And that was Adolph Hoffman and the Texans. And this boy, Smiley Whitley, that's when I was working out here at Jordan Ford, and I wasn't in the music business. I just made the recordings because I just thought I'd make them. And
were you working
as a mechanic?
Mechanic. Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So he said, "I'm going to copyright the name. You mind?" The Texans. I said, "No," because he wanted to get in the music business. He tried to talk me into going into it. I told him, "Man, I was tired of starving to death. I'd rather settle for $14-$15 a week, knowing I'd get it." See? So I did. So we made the records, and they come out, and I guess they sold pretty good. Never in them days, they paid you. Maybe they gave you $5-$10 a piece for making them. That's it. No royalty, no nothing. In other words, you got your popularity out of it, and they got their music, and that was it, you see. All right, so I told him, I said, go ahead. I didn't care. If you wanted to copyright the name of Texans, well, that was all right with me. So he did. He had a copyright. When he put Smiley Whitley in the Texans, I could have come back. Adolph Hoffman, the Texans guy, I knew that, you see. But I didn't care. Because, like I told him, I said, I appreciate them helping me, you see. And I tried to give them as much out of it as I could. Well, so I worked out there for about 3-4 months, I guess, mechanic. And then Tom Dickey and the Showboys, he was working around. He was starting out a band. He had a program on WAI.
Who was this now?
Tom Dickey.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the Showboys.
Yeah, yeah. They made a bunch of records.
Yeah. I was responsible for that. All right, so Tom come by my house one night. He said, man, he said, you're just not doing nothing, man. He said, why don't you come go with me? And he said, you know you can make some money. He said, I'll even guarantee you $4 more than you're making here. Guarantee you $20 a week. And to just start off with, he was starting a band. So I figured it over and I said, well, might as well. So I got back into it, and then my second session came up with RCA. So I told Mr. Walker was in charge then. I told him, I said, I'd like to use this band I'm with, you see, and just put it under my name. But I said, I'd like, in return, put one or two records with Tom Dickey and the Showboys, you see. In other words, put it all together to where he could get some publicity out of it, you see. So fine and dandy. We went ahead and made that. I forgot what I made. I think I made 3 or 4 sides. Three sides, maybe. No, it must have been 4, because they took them in. And I think I made 8 sides in all. 4 sides with him, 4 sides with myself. Mm-hmm. And one was, gee, it's great after being out late, walking my baby back home. That was one I made with Tom Dickey. I believe it was Tom Dickey. And then I made... under his name, I don't know whether it came in my name or his name. See, I get mixed up there. I just don't know. I should have kept a record of it. But at that time, there was just as the session was about to be over, why they found out about this. Makes no difference now, you see. That was delayed. They found out that the song was getting hot and said, can you guys learn it? And said, we'll just go ahead and put it out. And well, of course, so I got, man, I'm telling you, I really wrote down some words and listened to Makes No Difference Now. And if you notice, I made a slight little boo-boo there, but they passed it on some of the words and one part of it. Maybe nobody else noticed it, but I knew it was there. So.
Did that come out under Tom
Dickey and the
Showboys' name?
And yeah, now had it come out in my name, if they'd been put on my name, why, it'd been too bad for Tom. But anyhow, the song clicked, you see, because Decca went on strike right after that. And even though Dickey had a much better recording, because his was well rehearsed, you see, we just picked it up and had to learn it in an hour. So you can imagine how that was. But we learned it, and it came out fairly well. But that son of a gun was solid on every dang jukebox around there, man. Every jukebox around there. Makes no, I heard myself singing, it makes no difference now. And actually, that boosted his band, you see. Well, in just about 4, 5, 6 months, well, we was making a killing everywhere we went, you see. So it really paid me off to get in that business, see. But the hell, if I'd been smart, put it on my name, but I was always easygoing about this stuff. All right. So I think about 6 months later, I got a royalty check. That's when they started paying royalties. I got a royalty check for $101. And him and I had been disagreement. He kind of, you know, professional jealousy. In other words, more people would respond to me, but yet I had announced every song and all that. He didn't want to do it. He had me do it, you see.
What did Tom Dickey play himself?
A fiddle. He played fiddle. And he played good corn fiddle.
Who else was in that band, you remember?
There was Milton McBee. Bless his soul, he wanted to do exactly what you're doing. He was after me, made several tapes. He was going to bring that all together, but he passed away before that one. Milton McBee, he played banjo, and a fella by the name of Smokey somebody played saxophone. Tom Dickey played fiddle, I played guitar, and let's see, Bill Dickey, his brother, played bass. That's all there was, how many pieces. I don't think we even had a steel guitar. Then later on, my brother came back in from, he left Jim Rebard up in Kansas, and he come back, so Tom Dickey hired him. We had six men then. And let's see, how the heck did that? Well, somewhere in the process, I made some recordings, no? Jim Rebard came back, and he was playing around here, and he got on the Texas, no, that was a Tune Wranglers, Leonard Seagull played with.
Was it
two? Tune Wranglers, you remember them?
Yeah.
See, Tom Dickey used to play with the Tune Wranglers, and he branched off of them.
Oh,
him and the partners didn't get along.
Were the Tune Wranglers from San Antonio, too?
Yeah. It broadcasted right over KTSA over there. That's what gave them their popularity. They were a household word. Buster Card, Bill, Tom Dickey, and Eddie Fielding. That was the origin of Tune Wranglers. Eddie Fielding, and Charlie Gregg on bass. Mm-hmm. And then later on, they hired my piano player. He was one of the original Tune Wranglers. Well, anyhow, getting back to that, so I played with Tom Dickey, and then after I got my check for this royalty, $101, I went down and bought me a PA, and I had almost a new car, you know. So I decided I'd invest in instruments, start my own band. And that's when it happened, May 13, 1900, and 40 years. And right over here in Lemming, if you're going down the valley, well, you'll see it on the right-hand side. Right after you pass Lemming, there's a barbecue place and a big tree in front of it. That was my first job. We made $5 a piece. But then I say that then come the recording session again, you see. And so Jim Rebard didn't have a band then. That's right, the band, but he had a recording contract. So I told him, I said, okay, Jimmy, I'll tell you what we do. I said, use my band, play under your, I was going to do the same thing I done with Tom Dickey. And I told Mr. Walker about it and said, might as well. I said, we'll change it a little bit, make it sound different. We'll have a horn on one. And in the process, I recorded again, must have for Victor, because then the second time I used Neil and Bill Ruff. And I used a horn in my band, clarinet. I couldn't tell you. And my brother, no, Smiley Wicker was still with me. And my brother played banjo. No, I didn't use Bill, I used Neil Ruff. No, I used beetle rope. Clarinet, my brother played banjo, because I had Smiley Whitley playing steel guitar on there, you know. So that was the second session that I made under my name, RCA. That was before I started my band again, you see. I don't know. It's all kind of a mess. But anyhow, then we got the Jim Revar. He came back that didn't have a band. I said, you got a contract? I have one. The guy's going to be in Dallas. I said, why don't we just go over there and both of us record, you see. So, okay, we did. We went out there and recorded. He recorded some of his stuff. And that's when he recorded Hole in the Sack. I think you've got that. And that was my band he recorded it with. Hole in the Sack, if I'm not wrong. And then I went ahead and recorded 8 for myself and 8 for him. You see, then they were paying union wages. That made it very attractive, you see. The scale then was about $33 per session, which included 4 songs. So we walked out of there with about $150 a piece, so that's the reason of this double business, you see. So, all right, I went over there, and I must have recorded Maria Elena then. No, that Maria Elena. Where'd that come in? That was at the Blackstone Hotel. I recorded Maria Elena. Yeah, that's when I first started my band. That must have been in 39 or 40, early part of 40. And, of course, I had 2 fiddle players. Yeah, I had my own band. That was a session in between. And that's when I recorded Maria Elena. I'll tell you why in a minute. We recorded Maria Elena and on that session, and on that session was Buck Wheeler, my brother Bash playing steel, Johnny Reeves was playing fiddle, Leonard Siegel on that Maria Elena session was playing fiddle. And
2 fiddles.
Two fiddles. Bert Ferguson was playing piano and I was playing standard. That made 6 men, right. That was the session that we made in 40. And now Jim Revard wasn't involved in that. That's when I first more or less started my band. And so we recorded at the Blackstone Hotel. We was going good then, come to think of it, because I offered to give the guys a guarantee of $50 a week and they didn't want to take it. You know, because someone were griping about this and about that. So I said, tell you what, I'll give you guys, all of you guys, $50 a week. And we leave it go. And I said, I'll figure about, they were grappling about expenses and stuff like that, you see. So, but anyhow, they didn't want to take it. No, once they're on Commonwealth, you know, split even. So we must have been doing good before Maria Elena. So, all right, we went up there, Blackstone, and J.R. Chetwell, no. Now, how did the heck did that come about? Yeah, that was Leonard Siegel, all right. All right, that was Leonard Siegel. Now I'm getting my OK. And RCA mixed up.
It was Walker was.
Walker was OK. Was with RCA.
Oh,
he was with RCA.
Oh, Art Satherley with.
Art Satherley is the one that was with OK or Columbia. All right, so we went over there and recorded that Maria Elena, the deal that confuses me, I know I tore up my contract with Victor because he told me that he didn't sell enough of Maria Elena. He didn't give me any royalty on it. All he gave me was, he said it didn't cover enough to pay what he paid me. And I said, that can't be. I said, there's enough jukeboxes in Texas to cover that. And I said, anywhere you went. I said, it was, and I told him, I said, might as well forget about recording. Yeah, so I must have made 2 sessions there. Yeah,
you must have, because with Chadwell, I think you must have recorded for Victor.
All right, that was in, must have been in 39 and then early 40.
I think earlier.
Early 40. I can't tell you. I get a little confused. Well, anyhow, we recorded that Maria Elena, and after that went like a house fire, and back by, if you can get a hold of the recording,
the Spanish two-step.
Two-step, right. Because I remember when I forgot what else I recorded on there. A bunch of original stuff, you see. That's what they wanted. They wanted original. So, first time I heard Maria Elena, I thought it was about the sourest thing you ever saw. That whining steel back there, you see. But that proved that And it seemed like it wasn't quiet up the pitch, and I played it halfway through. I said, that'll never do. I heard my voice, and it's somewhere it seemed like it cracked a little bit, but that's what sold it, you see. And anyhow, I guess that's what sold it, because to me it wasn't perfect. But the more I heard it, the more it grew on me.
Is that an old waltz that you...
It's a waltz. Maria Elena, first time I heard that waltz, this Simon Garcia that played Duke with us sang it to his girlfriend, one of these serenading things, and I just picked it up. See.
Did you guys used to go serenade with Mexican guys?
Yeah, I did right here. Simon Garcia used to take a serenade his girlfriend. I guess she's his wife now. Uh-huh. Got 4, 5, 7 kids, maybe. I don't know.
Did you ever serenade on Mother's Day too? When they do that, still around here?
No, I haven't. That's the only person I ever went serenading with.
See,
but they were real nice. They invited us for coffee. I told them, I said, man, how do you know they might sick the dogs on us or everything else? Throw shoes at them. But they didn't. They opened windows open, man, and there they listened to him sing, "So tu eres mi corazón."
And you just translated the words.
ASCAP came out with the words I used. And after I saw it was Southern Music or Peer International, I said, heck, that's for me. I love the song, you see. So, okay, because we played a lot of these Spanish songs, like Rancho Grande and what the heck was it? Some of these songs that we played around with, El Salazar and this Hawaiian music, you see. We played a lot of that stuff. And so... anyhow, it impressed me, you know, and so anyhow, when the BMI came out with the, when Peer International came out with the words, it's an old traditional song, but they put,
they claimed the
Peer International put the words to it and they claimed the copyright.
And they printed sheet music.
Right, you are, all right. So they had all the rights to it. And I recorded mine under the ASCAP version. Well, that's when the networks banned, they banned all this stuff, see, about that time, the musicians went on strike.
I think the union did, yeah.
Union went on strike, no more musicians. Well, I was sitting there with the recorded material, all these other guys were just singing it with voices in the background, you see, and the song was number one on the Cotton Pickin' Hit Parade for about 21, 22 weeks, so you can imagine what it done to me, but the only musical one was a big boost for me. So it was solid. I don't care what jukebox, what radio station you turn on, Maria, I couldn't believe it, man. When it started happening, I said, hell, what's going on? And sure enough, one station, you could turn one station, one another station. It's kind of a funny feeling, man. Really, it's the first one I've had and the last one I guess I've had. That's solid. Last one I'll ever have. But it didn't give me no big head, man. As a matter of fact, I don't know why. The song, I still don't feature it. And on why I don't know. After I recorded it, it seemed like it soured me, my first impression of it. And I never did care for it. I should have improved on it, I guess. But so much for that. And so that was made on RCA Victor, and that's what it was. We went to Fort Worth, we recorded again, Jimmy Rivard and myself. That's when I tore up my contract. But about the best song I made with Jimmy was, Someone Thinks of Someone. Yeah, that's the one I made with Jimmy Rivard. That was, thought it was perfect. Instrumentation, I was just sorry it didn't come out on my label. It didn't sell for him, I guess, because he was inactive and everything, you see. But my voice, it seemed like it just blended. And darn it, I don't know why the fiddlers came in just right. It was just boys together, if you find it anywhere.
You like the sound of that, right?
Someone Thinks of Someone. Yeah,
I'll try to find
Mistakes. Mistakes.
That was the title of it, Mistakes?
Mistakes is the one that's perfect.
By Jimmy Rivard and this...
Jimmy Rivard and the Oklahoma Playboys. We make mistakes when we're... and we're sorry.
That was also one of those crooning type.
Songs. I thought that I'd done. That's the best song I ever sang in my life on the record. Okay. Mistakes. Uh-huh. Oh, if you find that somewhere, why? Remember
that.
All right. Well, anyhow, we tore up my contract about that time. Then Columbia Arts Saturday came through. He wanted to hear what I had to offer him. Wanted to know what I wanted, and so we made a deal. And we went to Blackstone Hotel. and recorded. That's when we recorded Cotton Eye Joe. And we were the first ones to record that Son of Gun for the modern version of it. And we made a bunch of other songs like, let's see, another song that hit pretty good was, well, we had a
Was that Alamo Steel on the same session?
Alamo Steel was later.
That was later.
That was still later. Let's see, what was it that did Star in Heaven Tonight? There's a Star in Heaven Tonight. That was pretty well saturated here. And let's see, what was it? Sagebrush Shuffle was later. We made something else. Oh, gosh.
But someplace along the line, you used J.R. Chatwell once.
That's the one. That's the one. See, J.R. started working with me in 1941. And so J.R., when he went with Bob Wills, Leonard did, went with Bob Wills, my original fiddle player, went with Bob Wills. And so I started using J.R. Chatwell, and he was the one on the record. And he worked with me from 41 through 45, 46, I guess. And he was with Harvard, then the record, boom and boom. The war came on, they didn't have enough shellac, so that threw me in a cramp. Right at the start of the war in 41, we went all to Columbia, took us all the way to Columbia Studios in California.
Was it to Los Angeles?
Hollywood, Los Angeles. And we made 12 sides over there. But it so happened things were against me. I had a German name, and we were fighting the Germans. Adolf Hoffman was
Especially Adolf in front of
that. Especially Adolf in front of that. So that's another story, you see. So they didn't even worry about me, and I had some beautiful numbers on there. I had a palace down in Dallas, and some beautiful numbers on there, man. The band was really good. Finally, he finally released one or two of them, I think. They've still got them backlogged, never even released them. I've got, he released three recordings. Swing with the Music, Alamo Steel Serenade, Sagebrush Shuffle, and let's see, what else did he release?
And those were done in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
And who were the guys playing with you on that session?
It was, Walter Clappus playing piano, Adley Frazier playing bass, J.R. Chetwell playing fiddle, Johnny Reese playing second fiddle or two fiddles, and my brother Bash playing steel.
Oh, he played the steel.
And he played the steel, and what else am I? And drums, well, we doubled on drums. That was and me playing guitar, that was six pieces. By that time, I was about the first string band in this territory to start using drums outside of Bob Wills, but he was out of Oklahoma. But in this territory, they didn't use any drums with these string bands. However, there was one band that played, well, kind of, what the heck is it? One band here that's pretty old too. I don't know whether they made records or not. But I was about the first one to start using drums to give it more rhythm. Man, I try every which way to give it more punch, I amplify my guitar, but it still didn't give it that boom, boom, boom. Now, I like Bob Wills' rhythm later on. Boy, the way that rhythm, the way that stock, man, I thought that was it. And I tried to copy that Son of a Gun to a T, but I couldn't do it without drums. Now, I couldn't afford seven men, you know, the bigger band is it. But anyhow, that's about the score of it. So he's still got about four or five sides, six maybe, backlog. But see what happened then, Foreman Phillips County Barn Dances in Los Angeles. They were interested in me, and so sadly, they kind of had a hand-in-glove situation, you see. He was a disc jockey, and Art Sedley was a big boy with the recording company, so it kind of went hand-in-glove, see. So the artist that he wanted, he put him out a record, which is what he done to me. But I Swing with the Music, and Alamo Steel Serenade.
Who was that fellow in Los Angeles again? What was his name?
Foreman Phillips.
Foreman Phillips.
Oh, County Barn Dances. So I went in and signed a contract and went on out there. But I changed my name to Dolph Hoffner. Dolph Hoffner and the San Antonians. See? Dolph Hoffner and the San Antonians. That's what I changed my name to on the OK label or Columbia label.
And then when, how did the Imperial things get started?
Oh, yeah.
Were and you had in
yeah, well, I got, or? Yeah, I was in Los Angeles, and then I worked there about almost 2 years, uh-huh. M. County Barn Dances.
Oh, you worked in the L.A. area?
Oh, yeah, uh-huh. Almost 2 years.
With your own band?
With my own band, yeah. I had about 9 pieces there. I took a bunch of boys with me from over here.
None of them had to go into service and all that?
Well, they were all, some of them were 4M, some of them were... too old, and some of them were classified with dependents, you see, and stuff like that.
Okay.
It was hard to get, man, hard.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Yeah, terribly hard. Mm-hmm. And what you could get, some of them were very undependable, man. Mm-hmm. Drove you crazy, but that's the way it was. They still do that. you can't predict the musician. But anyhow, so I was out there about, I took a 9-piece band out there. Took with me Elroy Gurdes, Chester McIntyre, incidentally, he's a big name by himself now on this trio work, you know. Mm-hmm. Chester McIntyre, and of all things, he played drums. He's one of the finest piano players. Mm-hmm. And I took a guy with me by the name of Ernie Elder. Oh, did Ernie go with me? Who played piano? No, Ernie Labordi, a fella from here, played piano for me. And Elroy Gurdes on one guitar, me the other, had two guitars. And Smiley Whitley on steel. And Johnny Rees on fiddle. And Leonard Seago on the other fiddle. Yeah, Johnny Rees, I kept the same fiddle section. And let's see, who else did I take? That's about, is that 9 men?
Oh, you take 9 men with you?
About 8 or 9.
This was several years after the Columbia thing, wasn't it?
Several years. Yeah, that was in 1945. The war just about ended.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, the war ended, and I don't know why I left. I should have stayed here. I'd have made a killing then. But it didn't hurt me to go over there, because a lot of people got the impression I went out there for pictures, you know. And when I came back, it was just mobs everywhere, you see. Uh-huh. There was a lot of boys were in service. They knew me when they left. So they wanted to see me, and we had nothing but mobs. So. Another story. Some of the guys there knew, anticipated my move, so they beat me back here in Texas to start their own bands. Mm-hmm. Oh, you'd be surprised. They got you with a knife if they can, man. But it all worked out all right, so I'd say it paid me off.
Was that the only session you did for Imperial, or did you record several times?
No. Now, when I came back, so I immediately went to KTSA.
Do you remember some of the numbers you did in that first, the one that you did out in Hollywood?
Imperial?
Yeah.
Well, the ones I did in Hollywood on this session with OK. They've had me a tires. I had to stick tires all over my bus, man, because I couldn't buy rubber, you see. And so I had to carry my own spare tires in a trailer. And all I could buy was beat up ones, but we made it there and back at 40 miles an hour, 35, whatever the speed limit was. And went to L.A. and we stayed there 2 or 3 days, recorded. We recorded 12 sides.
That was for Columbia.
For Columbia, yeah. 12 sides, like I told you, out of them sides, what came out was Swing with the Music was one.
Yeah, almost.
Element Steel Serenade, Sagebrush Shuffle, and let's see, what else was it?
That's all right.
Oh, he's got some wonderful ones backlogged over there if you could get him. He's got Wabash Blues.
Oh, really?
This J.R. Chetwell plays on 4-string fiddle. Oh, really? If you could get that stuff, man. Some of it's wonderful. And I've got some original stuff on there that's real good. I can't even remember it.
Maybe
You'd Better Settle Down is one of them. I know that. I remember that. Baby, You'd Better Settle Down. Kind of honky-tonky.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but then you came back here.
I came back here, and so naturally I got teed off
at Columbia.
Columbia, because I begged Art. I told him, I said, Art, I said, if you'll just give me a release during this war, he wouldn't give it to me. See, the only way he put it out, he let this guy. See, he made the masters for this guy, but just to play at that one radio station. See, he was on all these radio stations in California, so he had access to this stuff. He wouldn't release it to the public. He just gave it to the guy to play on the radio station. The guy, people would walk over and want to buy the record. It wasn't there, you see. That was bad. And I told him, I said, Uncle Art, I said, why don't you give me just one release, man? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll do it, I'll do it, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. But I'll do it never came around. Mm-hmm. So, boy, I was teed off plenty. So finally I told Art, I said, Art, I said, I'm going to go back. I said, if you want to release some of my stuff, you can. I said, it'll help me back there. Mm-hmm. I said, I'll appreciate it if you will. Mm-hmm. But those that he played there, he never released. He released like Sagebrush Shuffle, mm-hmm. Swing It with mm-hmm. the Music. He finally gave me three releases mm-hmm. over a period of 3 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this was all cut in 41. He didn't do this until about 40, 45, you see. Mm-hmm. And so I felt bad about it. So I knew my contract was out of him because they signed it for 2 years, I think. Mm-hmm. So Imperial came by and asked me what they want and what I'd want. I told them, I said, well, so you just want a fair deal. Mm-hmm. Pay me for the union scale plus mm-hmm. royalty. So he did. That's where I got tied up in Imperial.
And those were recorded here or out in
California? They were recorded right here in on the KTSA studios. But where we goofed. You see, they were recorded on 33 and 1/3, which was bad, bad, bad fidelity then.
Yeah, well.
Bad fidelity. And then they'd soup them up to 45s, you see, back there.
I have them on 78s. Yeah, they came out on...
And they came out on 78. Yeah. They soup them up to 78, and then the quality, they lost it. It sounded kind of whiny. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he didn't have... That's, I made a lot of... He wanted a lot of check stuff.
Yeah, that's what I gave him. Some of those are pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I gave him what he wanted on that check stuff, yeah. See?
And who was that band again? That was the big band that you had by then, the nine pieces or what?
No. Then I came back to San Antonio. I cut it down to about 7 and 8.
Uh-huh.
And so these recordings made on Imperial mm-hmm. were made by myself, my brother Bash, Charlie on the piano, and
Charlie, what was his last name?
Charlie Poss.
Charlie Past?
Poss. P-O-S-S.
P-O-S-S.
Charlie Poss on the piano. Oh, he's one of the old timers. Uh-huh. And then Charlie been with me for 30 years now. So told me he gave him the best years of his life. All right, and then let's see, who played Bash on steel, and then I had two fiddles. I had Charlie Gregg and Slim Wallace, a fellow I brought with me from California, played mm-hmm. fiddle. And then Charlie was on piano, and let's see, and Eddie Duncan was on bass.
Eddie Duncan. Mm-hmm. And what was that first fiddler's name again?
Charlie Gregg and the Slim Wallace.
Charlie Gregg. How do you spell that?
G-R-E-G-G. Charlie Gregg. Uh-huh. And a Slim Wallace. Mm-hmm.
And who was playing drums on those?
Drums on them things? Jimmy Blankenship. I'm glad you brought that up. Blankenship. Jimmy Blankenship was playing drums. He's still mm-hmm. around. Charlie Gregg passed away.
Because I like to put some of those. I like some of those. They had a good...
They did. Even though, I'll tell you what, if they'd been recorded right in a uh-huh. studio, that uh-huh. really sounded good. Uh-huh. But... Oh, he got disgusted. He said the steel player sounds like he's asleep over there. Huh. Because me, you know, and with 33s, you know, and when you check it up, you know, it just has a little different fidelity, you uh-huh. see.
How did that why did he want Czech music? Oh, because he was mostly into the folk dancing?
He was mostly with Spanish. See, Imperial at one time was strictly Spanish.
And folk dance.
Really. And folk. Yeah, yeah. See, so he wanted, that's what he wanted. But he did take the others, you know, also. Mm-hmm. And I made one that I thought was real good, played pretty well. Well, all the Czech music went over real great. I think he made a little money. He told me he didn't mm-hmm. make any money on me, but I think he did. Mm-hmm. But because they were too solid, man, like the mm-hmm. Ulida polka and Happy Go Lucky polka and Prune Walls, all those. Yeah. Why, I know he's bound to have made a little money. And then I made one... we're shining bright in Mexico. Mm-hmm.
You did the Prague polka.
Prague.
Or Shiner, whatever they call it.
They call it probably a Shiner song because uh-huh. that's what they call it around here, see. Uh-huh. But actually it's Prague. Farewell to Prague mm-hmm. is what it is. Mm-hmm. They call it Shiner because they had a brewery
but
out there.
But that probably just sold around here. Mm. Those Czech numbers probably
just. Yeah, that's the reason I put it. But it's Farewell to Prague. Is they smelled Pustili Prahu is what it is. Uh-huh. Not they smelled Pustili Shiner. It's they smelled Pustili Prahu. And you light them. And mostly all my Czech stuff, I put more on Imperial than I did on any other. I way back there, I made the Dreamland Walls on RCA.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an
on Columbia. You did a couple of, didn't you?
Yeah, on Columbia, I've done some Czech songs too.
I think I have some of those. I think also
I
have.
Golly, I don't know what the heck I've recorded. Man.
Because the Prague polka, I think, is one of them.
Yeah. Probably is.
I have to send you a list sometimes of all this stuff.
I know it, and then I made some. Then I turned around and I made the same thing on this guy over here.
Oh, Sarge.
Right? Sarge, yeah. Well, he wanted him, so I said, okay, there's nothing that says I can't do him after so long.
That's
right. So he wanted him, and so wait just a moment. Then I know you're trying to get it. And that's about the deal of it. Since then, I recorded for Sarge over here, got a bunch of stuff with him. And on Imperial, I don't know. Oh, yeah, wait a minute. Decca came along. I recorded all three. Decca came along, and they wanted me to record an album called Dancerama. Tex Williams was on it, and Bob Wills was on it, and Ernest Tubbs, I think, was supposed to come out. Milton Brown and his Brownies were on it, called Dancerama. He was going to put out, in other words, he was making that for the radio stations because it was music, one after another. You see, one after another, with enough space there just to, I don't know what. In other words, a disc jockey could just put it on and he figured out what it was slow, fast.
You made some for that.
Called Dancerama, yeah. Now, I had the album here, but it's all scratchy
and
everything.
But they didn't come out on singles?
No, he was supposed to release a single on me, but he never did. In other words, I cut that Dancerama. We went all the way to Nashville, recorded in Music Hall out there where we recorded all that stuff. And that was all done. Johnny Porter was on there, fiddle. Buck Hannon, fiddle. Eddie Bowers, vocal. And drums. Pee Wee Maples on bass. My brother Bash on steel. Charlie on piano. And me on guitar. And then he hired an extra man. I don't know who he was. It might have been Chet Atkins for all I know. He was standard standby. He hired him to play some kind of a rhythm that he wanted. And just guitar. He just played guitar and the mic all by himself. That's where they had all this business, you know. And to get the echo back, we were in the on the old opera stage, and he had a microphone that went out into the audience, you see. And it naturally is echoed back. See, that's where that was when the all echo was going so strong.
Of all the different kinds of music that you've played, like the popular, like the crooning, the Bing Crosby, or the Western swing, or the Czech, which of them do you think the people like the most, or is it hard to?
It's hard to tell. It all depends on moods, time of the evenings. In other words, if they've been dancing fast, well, they want to slow down. And if they've been, it's all depends upon. And also the popularity of the song. Now you take the songs like the You Light a Polka and stuff like that, they'll always go. Or you take Fräulein like it is now, it'll always go. Wild Side of Life, it's got an easy danceable tempo, you don't exert yourself, and the crazy arms, all this business, you see. It's got an easy danceable tempo, you don't exert yourself, and you don't sit there and drag one foot. And so that's why it's got its moods, and you as a band leader, you've got to watch your floor and see to it that you put the right stuff there at the right time, because if you don't do it, you're going to have an empty floor, you see. And especially at the first part of the evening, you throw at him everything that that they're going to dance, because it's hard to get people started dancing. But you throw at him, and you don't want to throw anything too fast because they won't do it. You got to start off kind of easy to where it's simple, and then they don't feel like they're just on the floor alone, you see. And something half easy. And waltzes, they'll always get on the floor in old-timey waltzes. They'll do that. Julie Blonde, if you noticed last night, that Westphalia Waltz, incidentally, I think I recorded that on just about every label.
That's right, that's another one.
But my best recording of that is on Sarge. Oh, I used the organ with it too, you know. It is beautiful.
Did you ever know this guy, Lester Wojtek?
Wojtek, I don't know if he's local or is he from upstate,
I think he's Iowa. He just made this weird thing called a melting pot polka one time, I remember, on Imperial.
He might have been out of Houston, Wojtek.
I think
he was out of Houston. But like I say, polkas are always for a lift. And when people have been sitting around and everything, why, in the latter part of the evening, the polkas always go. You always get a bang out of it because people are ready to let their hair down. So you just can't beat the polkas. And you can't beat waltzes for making people dance. The others, you got to pick out. But you get a good waltz, why, they'll always get on the floor. You'll always fill your floor with waltzes, young and old. I don't know why it is. But,
do you have any kids that are taking up music, or
No, there's so many of people have asked me, but to begin with, they were friends. I wouldn't have felt like taking their money. I didn't have the time to do it, so I just told them that, you know, that I'd rather they'd go to somebody that really knew how to teach. You see, and so because I felt it to be nothing but fair. Rather than me try to get somebody, I wrote down a bunch of chords for people and and several of them, you know, and give them to people for them to try out like I learned, you know. I'd go that route, but as far as me giving lessons, no, I just didn't. And like I say, I've had different types of bands. Yeah, not the ice cream trucks went by. Let me cue you in on something that was funny.
How did you start with sort of a sponsorship? Was that?
Well, yeah, that was kind of hard to get in them days, you know. And but being as I was on the radio, my first sponsor was Bugler Smoking Tobacco. They carried me about 6 months. And then I don't know what went wrong. Actually, they figured they didn't have to have it because tobacco was shy and war, you know. So here come along, and if they drop me, well, here come along, and Ripple Smoking Tobacco picked me up.
And they sponsored radio programs?
They sponsored me for 15 minutes. They didn't pay me too much money, $10-$15 a man.
But,
you know,
but I mean, you could announce your dances when you're playing it?
Right, right. That was my lifeline.
When did that start, the radio programs?
They started from as far back as I can remember. Even Milton Brownies and Bob Wells and...
When did you do your first radio broadcast?
First radio broadcast, 1939, under my own name.
At this
KTSA. Come to San Antonio. Yeah. And right now it's the biggest rock station you ever saw. But the variety, it was variety was what everybody was playing, you know. And actually they liked these country bands because they took them out to away from town. Even from out of their reach, like Corpus Christi all over, where they had other radio stations, but we was KTSA, so they got the listeners. See, they were glad of it. I had a program on 5 o'clock in the evening, and boy, I had a rush like mad to make some of these dances.
Did you have to take your whole band to the station?
Yes. Yes, sir. If you couldn't get them guys to do it now. But anyhow, what were we talking about?
Sponsorship.
All right, so... my first sponsor under my name was Bugler, then for about 6-7 months, and then about a couple of months later, Ripple picked me up. They carried me along about almost a year. Then here come along, Lone Star picked me up.
Lone Star Beer. Early 40s, you said?
That was in about 42. And they carried me all the way till the time I left for California. And when I left, as a matter of fact, when I was, one time it looked like I was going in service. And I made a whole bunch of recordings, you know, that they were going to play and keep me on the air after I was gone, you know. That was the policy then. So I made a whole bunch for them, you know.
Who has those now? Do you know who has any of those? You don't by any chance have those transcriptions?
No, I don't. But I've got a bunch of tapes that I have made with my band when I was on the air. Now, be interested in them,
I'd love to hear
would you? All right. With my bands later on. Yeah, okay. I'll send them to you.
And I'll just make copies and I'll send them right back to you. You know.
That's good. And let's see. And then after I left California and came back to Texas, that was about 40s, last part of 47 or first part of 48. Can't tell now. Well, I picked up another sponsor, Purr Brewing Company. Must have been about 48 or 49. Yeah. And I've been with them ever since,
and
30 years.
Always at the same radio station?
Always at the same radio station. I don't know why. I got hung on... No, then from KTSA, I'd go to KMAC, and then I'd go back to see it was KTSA on KENS. I was on KENS, which is now KKYX Kicks, I guess they call it.
I see, huh.
Yeah, the big station over there, strictly country western. But then they went to rock and roll, so I had to go to KMAC, and then the station changed names to Ken's. I went back there, and then I went back to KMAC, but between them two radio stations.
You mean they would pay for the time?
Per brewery would pay for the time plus pay me to
they would.
I've been in radio ever since, actually I've been in radio on since about 1935. And then after they quit taking bands out to stations, you know, they run different formats. Then I was a disc jockey over at KMAC and ran my own shows in the morning. And then they switched around. Then I KBOP over here. I was with them up until about...